everyone, and welcome to the ECCDC's first podcast of the new year in 2026. I'm your host, Jeanette Wilson, and I'm here in conversation with Dr. Dane Marco Di Cesare, Associate Professor and the Programme Director for the Bachelor of Early Childhood Education at Brock University. Join us as we discuss how early learning and childcare programmes and educators can build inclusive communities where two SLGBTQ plus families feel welcomed and a sense of belonging. During this rich conversation, Dane shares insight into the challenges that programmes and educators face when building more inclusive environments, and many practical strategies that can be utilised to build inclusive environments. So welcome, Dane. It's lovely to have you with me here today to engage in conversations around how early learning and childcare programmes and educators can build inclusive communities where two SLGBTQ plus families feel welcomed and a sense of belonging.
Thank you so much for inviting me today. I'm so glad to be part of this conversation.
Lovely, thanks. So to start our conversation off this afternoon, Dane, can you please share a little bit about yourself and your connection to the early learning and childcare community with our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm an associate professor at Brock University and the current program director of our Bachelor of Early Childhood Education program. I also worked for a time in childcare. An interesting story, it actually was the childcare center that I used to go to as a child. So I was there as a child, and then I sort of came full circle and then wound up working there later in life alongside a lot of the educators who taught me when I was young. So that was a really interesting experience growing up. I also have a child who went through the childcare system. Now is no longer a child. It's actually his 18th birthday. So I can no longer say, I mean, still my child, but so going through the childcare system, coming from a same-sex family with a child and then sort of experiencing that firsthand has really informed a lot of the perspectives on sort of where I am today and the research that I do engage in around supporting two SLGBTQ plus families. So being a queer child, sort of navigating school systems, then to becoming a parent of a child who had, same-sex parents and the different successes and struggles that we face sort of along the way through the childcare system. So I have a lot of experience from the research and academic side, but then also just personal lived experience as well.
Yeah, great, lovely. Yeah, it's really interesting when you've been in the profession a little while, when you see children that you had in your program coming back through that evolution. But great, so some really rich real life experiences that you can bring to the conversation. I love the research as well. I'm kind of a bit of a research nerd as well, so I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So, okay, let's dive straight into the topic of conversation by exploring the specific challenges that you see for programs building a more inclusive community. And how can educators address those challenges within their work?
Mm-hmm. I think some of the challenges that we see, one of them is a lot of educators sometimes rely on the way that things have always been done. So sometimes practices just feel relatively neutral on the surface. But they can actually reinforce inclusion, whether that's through language, assumptions around families, or even the kinds of materials that we might offer. So one example, and this is something I faced as a parent with a child in the child care system. So getting forms at the beginning where you're putting down parents' names, where the form automatically says like mother name, father name. So assuming that you have a heterosexual two-parent sort of household. So for me, like, that stings a bit. And then it's like crossing out the pieces, renaming it, or if we were more inclusive in what those forms looked like from the start, we could sort of start in a better place. And there actually were some childcare centers that, in receiving those types of forms, we said, you know what, this is not going to be an inclusive place, that we want to send our child to. So sort of keeping that piece in mind. And then, even fast forwarding to later in life when my son was in grade 9, receiving materials that he would get that would be sort of filtered that same way, like mother's name, father's name, and then how he felt about that. So then also like the impact that had on him as well. So there's sort of varying degrees of harm that can happen, and it's something that some people don't necessarily think about, but we have to take the time to think about these pieces. Another thing I think is often a challenge is discomfort. I often talk with, whether it's through workshops or just conversations, that educators want to be inclusive, but they're too worried about saying the wrong thing that they don't say anything at all, or they don't take any meaningful action. And I always say, if you are approaching this situation, at least from my perspective, if you're approaching the situation with respect, I'm okay if there's some mistakes or some stumbles, because I can see the effort that's being made. But we have to start somewhere. And if we are too worried about being uncomfortable to actually make change, then we're really just assenting to the way that things have always been. So we're acknowledging that there's things that need to change, but now we're becoming part of the problem if we're not actually taking the steps to make that change. So we have to figure out a way to sort of live in this discomfort. There's actually Sarah Ahmed is one researcher who talks a lot around that discomfort and how we have to get to that place and be okay feeling uncomfortable in order to make that positive change when it comes to issues around equity and inclusion. Another thing, just to sort of address some of these pieces, I think if we start with sort of curiosity and self-reflection, so thinking about who is represented, who is missing, what does that sort of like look like in the different materials that we have, in the language that we use, in the enrollment forms, in our classroom libraries, these types of pieces. I think that's sort of a good place to start, to start to sort of build on taking these challenges, confronting them, and then turning it into possibilities. I also think just in the broader context of where we're working, we're seeing a lot of just globally, so not in Canada as well, but then also across the globe, we're seeing a very noticeable rise in anti-trans, anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric and policy that can create a lot of uncertainty and fear for educators, for families, for children. And what it's doing is it's taking inclusivity and making it feel political. But the reality is, this is fundamentally about human rights. So I think sometimes there's now a bit more fear around having these conversations because of what the sociopolitical climate looks like. But I think another way to look at this is to think that, all of the steps we've taken in terms of equity initiatives are working because we're seeing this larger backlash. It's similar to how if you're working with a child who's engaging with, let's say, some negative behavior. So you're working on, let's say, like positive reward systems. And sometimes you see an increase in negative behavior a little bit first before it starts to change. I sort of think of it like that. We're seeing more backlash because we were actually making strides. So this is not the time to sort of crumble under that, but this is actually the time to really, really push back and make change.
Yeah, that's so I don't know if the word is disappointing or alarming that we've moved and now things are going backwards, but definitely being strong in our resolve. I also, some great strategies that you shared and some starting points there. But yeah, that concept of feeling comfortable with the uncomfortable as well. Yeah, and I know sometimes just people saying it's okay to get it wrong, it's a learning experience, and taking that step. Great, thank you. So I've been in the field a little while. I won't say how long, but it is a little while. And I know very much in my early career, when we thought about gender, it was more in those binary terms. Can you just share with us how that conversation has moved on?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And one of the things I think is important to start with is this notion of the sort of gender binary, male, female, is not universal. Actually, many cultures around the world have always recognized more than two genders. And it was actually colonialism that really started to impose this strict binary in many places around the world, sort of replacing or suppressing different understandings of gender diversity that had existed for generations, almost erasing it in some spaces where that became a bit of a sort of forgotten history. So we're seeing now a shift where we're starting to acknowledge again that gender isn't necessarily this male-female binary, but it's actually more of a spectrum. So rather than it being sort of this either-or, looking at it as being okay for children to express gender in many, many different ways, and it being our role as educators to make space for exploration without judgment. So it requires a lot of stepping away from gendered assumptions, as in what toys children should play with, what clothing is appropriate, what colors are appropriate, and instead just supporting children as they figure out who they are, sort of at their own pace. It reminds me of a quote that I once saw in an art exhibit. I can't recall exactly where the quote came from, but it said, "Some parents will do anything for their children except let them be themselves." And that always struck out to me as being like very, very powerful because, as parents, sometimes we say, and even as educators, like, yeah, we want children to just be who they are. Or we'll do anything for them. But then when they express who they are or what they're interested in, we then have to say, well, actually, no, this, you actually belong in this box over here. So we're then taking away that autonomy from them. And instead we start to sort of dictate what that looks like. And I think it's important to introduce gender in a more of a spectrum way with younger children. Hearing people say, oh, well, like they're too young to understand, and those types of pieces are just easy ways out of a conversation that you may not be comfortable with. So part of it is just practice, listening to different advocates, informing yourself on what exactly that means, and just practice saying it to yourself to become comfortable. That way, you can have that conversation with children much more easily. We can't do many things without practice. And sometimes, when it comes to the way that we use language, we do have to sort of practice. We do have to sort of practice that.
Yeah. So some great pieces there. I love that quote that you saw at the art exhibit. It's so true. And yes, so I know for myself, I'm trying to get away from, using gendered terms as well. And as you were speaking, it reminded me of so as you can probably tell, I'm a Brit originally, and at the beginning of this century, there was a Child of Our Times documentary over children's lifetimes, and they did I don't know if experiment is the right word, but what they did was they put children in clothes that were their opposite gender, and I'm going to revert back to gender terms, so boys in gender clothes and vice versa, and they put adults who didn't know these children together, and they were playing with the children. And what they observed was that the adults weren't generally playing with the children with gendered toys, in inverted commas, but what the adults were doing subconsciously was they were playing in a gender specific way. Which kind of made me think some of those, assumptions we make. Outwardly, we might be trying to not gender children, but some of our practices may be gendered without kind of realizing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of extending that a bit, the words, similar studies that have worked on these pieces. There was one I recall where they put babies in onesies that were either pink or blue, and then had strangers sort of like meet the babies and talk about them. And the language that was always used with the children in the pink onesies was very like soft and sweet. And then the language that was used with the children in the blue onesies was very, oh, like you're tough, you're like a heartbreaker, like all these types of things where we're starting to now put these societal norms on children like right from the beginning. I can't even tell you the number of times when, my son was younger, and we'd go out to a restaurant, and random strangers would come up, and they'd ask him, and he was would be like two or three, and they would ask him if he had a girlfriend, and start to like steer conversations in certain ways. So even though like my partner and I would actively be trying to make our language as inclusive as possible, we would then have to sort of push back in these moments because I didn't want some stranger coming in and then sort of disrupting what we're trying to achieve. But sometimes it's so built into our language and our culture in our society, particularly like speaking of in terms of Canada, but it's so built into our societal structures that we may not even be aware of it. And we sort of say some of these things without thinking. So it really does require a lot of reflection and sort of taking a step back to sort of unlearn some of those things that have been passed on to us.
Yeah, and that's a lovely segue into our next question, which is, around gender classification. It's embedded in our language, often unconsciously. So what practical steps can educators take to move towards using more inclusive language?
That's a great question. I think one of the first steps is really taking the time to pause and notice patterns that you use. Even honestly, like just journaling, to sort of take note of what you're seeing. So do you say, like boys and girls, like when referring to a collective, or like ladies and gentlemen, or are you using other terms like friends or everyone, or sort of something that's more inclusive? Another thing is when we're talking about people that we don't know, and this one could be really tricky because we do this so much, but talking about people that we don't know, and then we automatically gender them. So you see someone with like a really great like sweater, and you're like, oh, she's got an amazing sweater, but we're automatically like putting the like gender marker on that person when we don't know. So really like moving into more inclusive language, or moving into a neutral they, like, oh, they've got a really cool sweater. And just sort of building that into our practice. We also, interestingly, gender animals a lot, and we tend to, just as a society, gender most animals as male. So also even like when speaking around, like pets, or I have a dog and I have a million people who want to stop and talk to me when I'm like walking around. And one of the first questions they always ask is, boy or girl? And, a lot of times they say, like, doesn't matter. Like, Oscar doesn't care. It's not important. And at the end of the day, like, why is it important for us to know, like the gender of, or we call it gender, but I mean, dogs don't have societal gender. but it's something that we sort of deem important. So really taking that time to sort of notice the gendered language that we use, taking steps to change it, and also being comfortable using they. And for anyone who wants to say, that it just hits a grammatical nerve for them, newsflash, using they as a singular has been around as long as language. It is acceptable. It is appropriate. We can use a singular they. It's been around forever. And I actually find most of the people who try to push back against using they or them as a singular in their argument will often inadvertently use they and them as a singular in trying to say, like, this doesn't make sense to me. But we do use it. One of the examples I often give where we tend to use they is if something happens while driving with someone in another car, and we'll always revert to like, oh, they just cut me off. And you don't even realize it, but we do use that a lot. So you're using they in a singular form. So there's actually like it's actually deeper issues around, transphobia that are actually underlying as to why people sometimes have problems with that. It's not a matter of the language in and of itself. And then another thing is, if you're unsure, as long as it's coming respectfully, it's okay to ask someone's pronouns, as a way of being inclusive, like when you're meeting or even starting the conversation by sharing your own. And even if you're not using gender neutral pronouns, it still sort of shows that you see that value in that as part of an introduction. I'll also say children tend to ask a lot, is that a boy or a girl, right? That's sort of a question you'll often hear. I heard that a lot when, like we would be on field trips when I was working, back when I was working at a child care center, and like we would take a field trip to the zoo, for example. So they might ask, and my response was always, I don't know. Like we'd have to ask them, but we'd only ask them if we're friends. And it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. There, it's just a human walking by with another group of people watching the animals at the zoo. Doesn't really matter how they identify, but sort of having those just really open conversations with children. Children are capable of understanding more than sometimes we give them credit for. And I think there's a lot of us that sort of understand that, but I think sometimes we need a bit of reminding as well.
Yeah, and that's a great strategy that you shared, when the children are asking if it's a boy or a girl, you don't know, we'll have to ask. But also that secondary bit, only if they're friends. So also some other great strategies that you shared there. And yeah, as you were talking, it kind of reminded me that gender is a construct, a very Western construct as well. So, thinking about educators' day-to-day work, could you please share some specific resources, curriculum materials, tools that educators could use to incorporate diverse perspectives and experiences into their early learning and childcare curricula?
Yeah, absolutely. One book that I would just recommend everyone get as a starting point, it's called Supporting Gender Diversity in Early Childhood Classrooms. And it actually is it's a very practical guide. It goes through steps that first you take as a learner, then it moves into, okay, now what is it going to look like in practice? It has lots of anecdotes, lots of little case stories. From actual childcare centers in different places with many common examples that you may actually see. And I think it's a really good starting point to sort of begin your journey into being more inclusive. So this is more something for educators themselves. When it comes to some of the different materials or things that you would build into your like centers or curriculum, I think definitely making sure that you have a diverse array of picture books and materials available that aren't necessarily just showing like 2S LGBTQ plus families, but also like racialized characters, children with disabilities, all of those intersections as like a good starting point. But the little like asterisk to that is you can't tell if a book is inclusive just by looking at the title or the cover. So you really do have to go in and read it critically to reflect on who is represented, how they're represented, whose voices are centered, and even who is authoring the text. So these are some of the things that we have to sort of look at in advance because sometimes, I mean, it's marketing, right? Like, you want to have a really engaging cover to make you want to purchase the book, but it's really important to look at what is the content and is this actually okay? One of my personal favorite picture books is called A Peacock Among Pigeons by Tyler Curry. And it's a the story is of a peacock that finds itself born into a family of pigeons and doesn't quite fit in. And I won't give any spoilers around the story, but then just where it sort of goes from there. And one of the things I really like about that particular book is you can fit in, like, yes, it definitely has a like 2S LGBTQ plus like angle to it, but you could really fit in many different identities into the character of the peacock and what they experience over the course of the book. So I think that's one of my favorites, and it's a very prominent addition in my own personal library that I have of different children's books that I've used in coursework and then with my own child as well. So some sort of like additional prompts, I guess, to sort of think about when looking at these books. Does the book perpetuate stereotypes or does it offer depth and authenticity instead? Taking a look at the characters, are they full complex people or are they tokenized and included like just to sort of teach a lesson? And then are families and identities shown with dignity, joy, and really like everyday normalcy, not sort of looking at them as sort of othered. Another thing that I would also recommend, and this is something I know a lot of centers do, but may not necessarily think about how important of a resource this is, but really using like loose parts and open-ended materials because it can reduce gendered play stereotypes. Children decide how materials are used, so that's an important piece as well to include.
Yeah, I love loose parts for that piece that they're not gendered, able specific, non-age specific. Well, maybe some of those little parts, but yeah, they're much more inclusive. So some great points that you shared there and tips to support educators in reflecting and going, beyond the superficial to that more deeper level. And that the first book that you mentioned, having those anecdotes, those case studies as well. I know educators really like to have those.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, just following on from that, could you share some strategies how educators can set up their environments to be welcoming and develop a sense of belonging for everyone?
Absolutely. I think one of the important ways, but it may seem like a small detail, is how inclusion shows up just in the physical space. So what types of photos or posters are on the wall? What types of books are on the shelf? Where are the sort of different toys and materials organized just in terms of physical layout? What languages are sort of represented? And some of this can be tricky because a lot of the like different posters or materials really show very binary, stereotypical representations of boys and girls. So a lot of it requires being a bit creative and almost developing your own materials, and sort of like developing your own pieces. Not to say that everything should be like completely genderless. We live in a gendered society, but really showing a broad spectrum of what gender looks like instead of like pieces that are very, very binary. Even thinking around when we're looking at, sometimes we'll see posters that might feature, different community workers. So, for example, like firefighters. Are those images only like men in firefighting like uniforms? And then do we only see like nurses as female? And really sort of like disrupting what those look like in different materials. Or for example, like ballet dancers. There's a whole variety of gender spectrum when it comes to dance, but we'll often see if particularly with ballet, you'll only see like female people sort of like represented. So what do those pieces like look like from the start? Even when it comes to sort of like pretend play, like clothing materials, are there non-gender specific options? Are there gender specific options, and are they all together, or are they sort of separated and then categorized? And then do we have, if sort of a like the kitchen area is maybe next to like the pretend play, like dressing zone. Like, are we starting to gender like the location of where materials are? So it's like, oh, this becomes a girl zone. This becomes a like boy zone over here. Or are we sort of mixing up where things are actually physically located? I also think it's important in like the words that we use to think about what is the language that families are using at home. So not everyone might be called mom and dad, but are we incorporating the caregiver like language? So whether we have like grandma and grandpa, but then maybe we also have like Nona, or like Papa or Poppy, like different types of names for different types of parents. Do we bring in that into our centers to represent the families that are actually part? Which does require a lot of changing from year to year because we'll always have new children coming in with a new language that's using. And that can be really, really welcoming if we have a lot of those terms around and we're using them. One of the things with my own son, like having two fathers, so we each had a different name, and it was really difficult to get that incorporated into the context of the center because all of the children just wanted to say like daddy and daddy, which then made my son feel really upset because that wasn't my name. That was only one parent. So like, this doesn't feel inclusive to me. So it actually caused him a bit of distress. So sort of like working on that aspect, it shouldn't fall on the parents or the child to like bring that language in. It really falls on the educators to sort of do that work up front. What is the language that's being used in the home for the caregivers that are there? And how do we incorporate and introduce that into the classroom to be more inclusive?
Yeah, some great points that you raised there, and thinking about how we can be proactive as educators, and I love the term disruption. And something that I hadn't really thought of was, are our locations becoming gendered within our play spaces as well? So, yeah, great.
Yeah, like let's bring the blocks right into the kitchen. Let's just like mix all of these things together. You know, and it's interesting too, just sort of going back to the concept of toys. You know, when we look at like dolls, for example, one of the reason that we sort of use dolls as a toy is it's sort of preparing children for parenthood. But why is it that we feel like as a society, we only need to prepare who we deem to be like women or females or girls as the ones capable of like being parents, you know? Men, non-binary folks, like other people can also be parents. So why are we taking this one object that's meant to represent practice with parenthood and just putting it on one gender? And then, you know, it just leads to like larger levels of misogyny and what relationships look like earlier, where, okay, you know, when it comes to anything with parenthood and caregiving, that is a sort of quote unquote female sort of task. And we start that right at the beginning, right when children are young. So even rethinking, why are we framing this toy as a, you know, quote unquote girl's toy.
Some of those messages that we give children very early on in life. So, Dane, you are going to be facilitating a two-part session as part of the ECCDC's Esteem offering next year, shortly after this podcast will be going out, actually. So the two-part series is Every Child Belongs, Equity-Centered Practices to Foster 2SLGBTQ plus Belonging Within Early Childhood Spaces. What are the key messages that you feel will come from that two-part series, and what would you like people to leave with?
It's a really good question. It's going to be like a great promo for this session, and it's a very welcoming space. So I definitely encourage people to check it out. But I think one of the biggest messages is that inclusion isn't an add-on or something we do when we have time. It's a fundamental part of quality early childhood education, and it's aligned with not only both our professional responsibilities, but at least in Ontario, our legal responsibilities, because we do have the Ontario Human Rights Code, which is very clear that every person has the right to be free from discrimination based on gender identity, gender expression, family status, sexual orientation. There's many more sort of areas, but these sort of focus in on like 2SLGBTQ plus. So it's not something that's optional. It's really providing a part, it's really core in providing safe and equitable learning environments. And another sort of key message that I want to give is that children notice everything. They pick up on who is celebrated. They pick up on who is respected. They pick up on who is invisible. And when we intentionally include diverse families and identities, like a wide diverse range. And when I say that, I mean like with all of the intersections. So really, when we're speaking about like 2SLGBTQ plus families, they are many different like races, cultures, religious affiliation. So there's a lot of those sort of embedded, and we can't really take those identities apart. So it's really thinking about that as like this large, diverse, like and vast sort of whole. And I also really want to debunk the myth that children are quote unquote too young to learn about like 2SLGBTQ plus people. That really comes from this idea that of like childhood innocence. And it sounds neutral, but it's actually shaped by race, it's shaped by class, it's shaped by heteronormativity. And Catherine Robinson is one academic who really pointed out in a lot of work around this that this kind of quote unquote innocence isn't applied equally because it often leaves out children from marginalized or equity deserving communities, and it assumes that every family looks the same, which is usually heterosexual and sort of very, very like nuclear with just parents, children. That's it, like not even bringing in sort of like grandparents or other people who might live in the home. And what it ends up doing is putting a blame on difference instead of seeing biases that actually make difference look problematic. So that's sort of another important takeaway is sort of debunking that piece. Because if that's the case, you know, children learn about gender and relationships like the moment they're born because they notice who those adults are in their home, right? So if we're saying that children are too young to learn about like 2SLGBTQ plus people, that's saying, okay, so my child from birth was too young to have me as a parent, right? Like sometimes we equate sex and sexuality when we go into the too young piece, but like we see sexuality every single day. You see that in who your caregivers are in their relationship from a very young age. So there's those sort of important differences where we're bringing in harmful stereotypes if we start to say like, oh, they're too young for this conversation. They're never too young for the conversation. We just might not be equipped to have it. And I think that's really more along the lines of where that lies. And if we're completely avoiding any topics around 2SLGBTQ plus youth, we're really sending a message that those identities are either inappropriate or don't belong as part of the conversation. So that's why we have to be open and honest and inclusive in our early learning spaces, because otherwise we would be sending some really harmful messages.
Children, they really do notice everything for sure.
They do.
But I like how you kind of phrased that, putting the onus back on us as educators to be informed, to feel comfortable, and to make the time for this work.
Absolutely.
So, shifting gears slightly, could you please define what it means to move from being an ally to being an accomplice in the context of 2SLGBTQ plus advocacy and support? And what are some concrete steps that can be taken to transition from passive allyship to more active accomplices?
Absolutely. Sometimes when we think of like the passive ally, they, you know, say that they'll support. Like I support the they'll say I support the 2SLGBTQ plus community. They may speak positively about inclusion, but they're not necessarily taking any active steps to challenge inequity. Going back to that conversation around that sort of uncomfortable nature. Particularly then when it's uncomfortable or requires maybe using their own privilege to change, they're not able to engage in that. So that's what I see being the difference between a passive ally and an accomplice. An accomplice is always working. It's not like it's not like a Pokemon badge that you just earn and wear and you're done. I've done one thing, like I'm good. It's something that has to continue to happen. You have to continually be part of the conversation. So some really practical things in terms of being an accomplice is involving knowing when to call something out or sort of call someone in. So if there is something that is very harmful, like in the moment, and the impact is like serious and immediate, stepping in to actually call that out in that moment, which can be uncomfortable, but being able to do that because otherwise the silence could really sort of reinforce some harm. So in situations where That harmful language or behavior is really causing harm in that moment. Alternatively, we can call in someone to have a conversation that involves some empathy. It's still accountability, and doing that through dialogue, helping someone understand why something that they did may have been problematic, and giving them the space to grow, giving them the tools to sort of change and unlearn. So we really want to use like that calling in piece when you notice something, but there's not that immediate harm. So then following up a little bit later with a conversation. There's lots of really good resources, even if you just like do a broad search on like calling out and calling in statements. There's a ton of resources that actually give you like sentence starters for how to do that. And it also requires practice. So whether it's just sitting there with some colleagues or friends and just sort of practicing having that conversation, how would you word things, sort of like workshopping it a bit, because it can be uncomfortable the first time that you're doing it, especially if you're coming from that perspective of, oh, like I don't want to do this wrong, I have to get this perfect. But it's okay to be a little messy, because we have to be able to move forward, to be able to move forward with change. So things like speaking up when we hear exclusionary comments or practices, things like reviewing our center policies, our forms, our documentation to remove heteronormative assumptions, advocating for inclusive materials and even professional learning within your workplace. Making sure that 2SLGBTQ+ families are represented consistently, not only during Pride Month, and also building relationships with different either community organizations or advocates or educators to be able to help us inform and change our practice. So where do we find some of those spaces? So I really think sort of a long answer, but if I wanted to like hone it down to like one point, it's really about action. So going from I support this, which is more of like a passive ally situation, to I'm willing to help change this is more along that like active accomplice.
Yeah, so that the way that you summed that up, from passive to I'm willing to help change. And I really like that calling out and calling in. I'm going to be Googling that myself. And I know it is really great to have those, go-to starters that you spoke to when you're having those conversations to start off with. I know personally I find that really helpful, and I'm practicing as well. Any conversations. So yeah, great.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we are coming to the end of our time together, Dane, and as we finish up our conversations, is there any training or professional development opportunities that you would recommend for educators to enhance their understanding of cultural competence and inclusive practices?
Absolutely. Well, aside from attending the session, I also do think really tapping into like the ECCDC professional development series that are just ongoing is like a really good place to start, because you always offer so many great and not I'm just not speaking about the one that I the one that I want to do, but but others as well. There's always so many great opportunities there. But one thing that I think is sometimes an unexpected place is actually following like advocates on social media. So I even recommend like creating your own sort of social media account separate from your personal one, where you're just following advocates. Because there's so many people that are constantly posting content to help you really think about and like learn differently and also unlearn as well. So not just necessarily in like an early childhood context, but in a context for your own learning and understanding. So like for example, like the Conscious Lee, is one advocate who does a lot around race, particularly around anti-Black racism, but then also brings in lots of other perspectives as well around indigeneity to us LGBTQ plus communities. And it's all done to sort of help you think about from like that adult perspective, what do I need to change? What do I need to sort of unlearn? So I think building a sort of separate social media feed in that sense can be really helpful because then you can sort of go in and use that as like part of your learning. Aside from that, just always being on the lookout for different community organizations that are hosting events, workshops, conferences. The thing is, developing cultural competence and inclusive practice, it's not like a one-time thing. It's honestly a continuous process of listening, learning, adapting. And there are some really, really great opportunities here in Niagara. There's also the Métis Early Learning Conference every year. It's local to Ontario. It's usually at White Oak, so it's very, very close. I do believe that they are full this year. So if someone is not registered, this would be sort of like a next year thing. But they have so many great resources and materials, and it's really a great conference. The faculty within the Bachelor of Early Childhood Education program at Brock, like we go every year to be able to incorporate practices into our own teaching and learning. So a lot of it is just being on the lookout and just really starting to develop and continuing to develop that critical eye in the media that we consume, the things that we see, and being able to have some of those conversations. Equity and inclusion, like it's not an add-on. It is incorporated and embedded into everything that we do. So I think we need to stop looking at it as, oh, this is this additional piece that I now have to think about. Like, that's not actually how it is. It really needs to be infused through the things that we're already doing. So it's really about looking at our practices through a different lens than taking something new and adding it to what we're currently doing.
Yeah, that's a great point. To finish, it's not an add-on, that it should be, through everything that we do. I know when you were speaking to, social media, somebody that I like to follow is Shelley Moore. She
Oh,
does the
yes.
5 More Minutes.
Yes.
Yeah, when additional needs, special needs, whatever terminology people use. But there's so many great ones. We could spend here bouncing
We
ideas off each other
could.
for a little while. But yeah, so I do encourage, listeners, if you have any, feeds that you follow, to share those in the comments as well. So Dane, thank you so much for sharing your time with me and our listeners, and sharing such great insight, wonderful tips, so useful, things that we can use to move forward. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you and our educators. I'm sure they're going to have so many things to take away. Thank you so much.
Yes, no problem. Thank you so much for having me here, and this has been fantastic.
Great, thank you. So that wraps up our conversation on building inclusive communities where 2S LGBTQ plus families feel welcomed and a sense of belonging. Thank you, Dane, for sharing your time with me and our listeners, and for prompting us to unlearn. Some of my key takeaways are that we need to feel comfortable with discomfort, and that equity and inclusion are not add-ons. We need to embed and incorporate equity and inclusion in what we do. If this podcast has sparked your curiosity and you would like to learn more about building inclusive communities where 2SLGBTQ plus families feel welcomed and a sense of belonging, then join Dane for a two-part series that he will be facilitating via webinar on the 3rd of February and the 3rd of March. You can register for Dane's sessions via the ECCDC website under the Professional Learning tab. or click on the link below in the show notes. If you liked this podcast, please leave a comment below. And if you haven't already done so, please subscribe. Until next time, stay warm.